Welcome to the Learning Well podcast, where we take learning seriously, but not ourselves.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Learning Well. We have a really interesting show today. Over the past few podcasts, we worked really hard to bring you some learning science experts that have helped us better apply these different types of learning sciences to our practice as designers. So one of the ones we heard a lot of feedback about was the science of linguistics. And to be fair, I did some research on that and I found myself either way deep in the weeds on like certain tones even and the way you move your mouth. Interesting, but I wasn't sure really like the application to everyday work as an instructional or learning experience designer. So as I was trying to figure out what's the best approach to take on this podcast with linguistics, I heard about and saw with our company a professional development session led by one of our resident writers, and the light bulb kind of went on for me. I'm not so sure she's as excited as I was about it, but it really dawned on me that if we're going to talk about language in the context of learning, what we're really looking at is writing. And how do we write well? How do we write interesting? How do we write creatively? So before we get to any of that, I'm excited to introduce to you Christina. Christine is a really experienced writer. Why don't you share with us a little bit of your expertise, your kind of your background, Christina?
Yeah, you're right. And I'm not always excited about being on a microphone. I always think like, you know, I spent my whole life developing this writing career so that I could avoid this kind of thing.
I'm just communicating through writing.
But I've spent a lot of years writing for industries as diverse as the pharmaceutical industry and automotive, and did a little teaching at the University of Michigan early on and worked in public television. And in my other life, I'm also a poet. So that's something my kids are like, don't ever tell people that, Mom. But
oh, no. On this podcast, that really boosts your credibility here.
Yeah. And I do think that it brings a perspective to what I do. And I am going to talk a little bit later about one of the things that I carried over from that world into this one in my everyday work.
Well, there's a ton of crossover, I think, with learning, and especially as we seek to motivate people and keep them engaged with all of the previous work that you've done in those industries. So that's why we're so excited to have you. And I mean, I'm sure if you had a choice, you'd write this maybe and give it to me instead. But I'm excited about just the conversation that we're going to have. So just as we get started, I want to set a little context. We have done quite a bit with learning science, as I mentioned, and linguistics is a pretty broad field. We can go a lot of different ways.
Yeah, I'll cut in here and say we did start talking about linguistics when we first started planning this. And I think I was quick to say that that's not my specialty. There are people who work in a very high level on things like semantics and semiotics and things that are very theoretical and pragmatics. But what we do in our work, or what I do at least, is pretty grounded in, I'm sure what you would call it, maybe practical linguistics. So we're mostly going to talk here about writing style and ways to keep our writing simple and to communicate best at a very practical level.
That's actually perfect. One of the things we've said all along in this podcast is that we want this to be something that someone in the learning industry would maybe throw on the way home, right? On their car, they're like riding, you know, the subway, whatever. So we do want this to be really practical.
Yeah. And the other, I like to also, whenever I get into a conversation like this, want to make it clear that while I am only about a step and a half away from being a gray-haired lady with the readers on a chain, that I'm not going for a grammar police approach here. And my goal personally is to make writing accessible not only to the people that we're writing for, but also for writers, so they don't bring along too much baggage from whatever their schooling was or teaching about, you know, doing things correctly and everything. I don't want to do that kind of policing. I want to do more encouraging and fostering. So
I know I think that's really important, and especially in the world we live in, all different kinds of clients, all different kinds of content, which call for different ways of writing, I think, in different styles at times. And sometimes those rules can trip us up, or those rules can really, I think, keep us from writing it in the best possible way for that audience. One of the things that was brought up, it's kind of an umbrella really for our, you know, three ways we can make our writing simpler, is plain language?
Yeah,
plain language. Can you explain that a little bit, maybe, and what that is?
Yeah, plain language is a term for a style of writing that brings writing down to its simplest form. And that doesn't mean dumbed down. It means it's most clearly comprehensible. And there are a number of different ways that you can make your writing clear and plain like that. And there's a value to that for people who are coming to English from another language, yeah, or people who have different learning styles or differences. And the government has recognized that value too. And there's a law that was passed in 2010 that requires government websites and documents to all be written in plain language. And they may or may not do that successfully, but...
Right. I was not the ones, yeah, I've read, but yeah, that's okay.
So I think it's good, and I'm kind of, you know, pro accessibility in all areas, and I like that. Yeah. And so I've used a couple of the things that we'll talk about today do have to do with plain language. But if you're interested in that, it's... If you look it up online, there are a lot of good places where those principles are outlined really well, and they will help your writing overall.
Well, and I really wanted to emphasize for our listeners to what you said. It doesn't mean dumbing down. It right. means writing in such a way that is most easily accessible. And I have had a couple actual real life experiences in probably the past month where those principles have become crystal clear to me, because as I was listening to somebody, it took me a while to put my finger on what was going wrong, but I couldn't follow what they were saying. I couldn't follow the action as they were commentating. And I realized after listening to you that it wasn't spoken in the simplest manner possible, and verbs mm-hmm. came in the wrong place. And that's a whole separate pet peeve I have, but it was really interesting how what you and I talked about applied to that situation. Uh-huh. And I can't imagine if English wasn't my first language.
Yeah,
I would have no idea what was going on.
Yeah.
So in order to make this podcast hopefully simple, easy to follow, we'd identified kind of three ways that our listeners can work to make their writing simpler. And the first one has to do with word choice. Mm-hmm. So can you kind of unpack for us what that really means?
Yeah, word choice is referred to in the business as diction. And it's, you know, the word is the simplest building block that we could have. I mean, there's, if you really break it down, there's like the sounds that we make, but we're dealing with words, and it's the first thing that we can be intentional with when we're
love
writing.
That. Yeah.
So we're really looking at, in English, our vocabulary draws from a lot of different languages. Our English is very rich. Other languages have that as well. But looking at English, we draw words from a lot of places. And primarily, I think most of them probably are either an Anglo-Saxon rooted word or a word rooted in Latin, or Latinate word, we would say. We also get words from Greek and all other lots of different places. But I think most of them you can break down into looking at your choices of words and saying, I have two buckets I could draw from here, Anglo-Saxon or Latinate. So...
Yeah, give me some examples here that'll help.
So Saxon, the way that you can remember it, if you're just coming into this and thinking like, oh yeah, I heard this thing about the way words break down, how do I remember which one is which? Saxon is action.
Oh, okay.
So Anglo-Saxon words tend to be more direct and shorter and punchier. And so we have words like eat, drink, think, pick, we can look at any of those and try to think of their Latinate equivalent.
Okay, so, sure, yeah.
How about the word eat as a verb?
So I'm trying to think of like a longer...
You're gonna eat some food.
Okay. So I'm trying to think of something like a more expressive word probably is Latinate?
No, a Latinate word is just... It sounds often more technical and...
Oh, like chew?
So you have to think of a synonym. You're gonna eat this food or you're going to... I'll give this one to you.
All right. You're making this really hard.
Sorry. Consume the food. We have to do a few. And then, It would sound strange, though, if I said, oh, hey, Miriam, I'm going to lunch. I'm going to consume some soup.
Right.
You want to go consume lunch with me? Right. Like, that just doesn't work. But when we're writing, we might have another occasion where we use that word. But it would definitely be a more formal or technical situation where we'd say, you're going to consume something when you mean eat.
So formal resonates with me. Like that makes sense in my mind. It's
okay.
The Latin is a more formal way of saying things.
Yeah. Formal or technical.
Okay.
So let's skip to think.
So maybe like contemplate. Or,
That's a good one. That wasn't on my list, but.
Okay. What did you get?
Oh, well, I had cogitate.
Okay.
I don't even know what it contemplate I would be more likely to use, but, or even just imagine. I don't know.
Imagine.
I'm guessing there. I could be wrong, but I think it's a Latinate. But yeah, think or contemplate, pick.
Okay.
Pick the option that you like best.
So choose.
I'd say probably select would
select.
Be our Latinate.
Okay. Okay. I'm not doing well in this quiz.
No, it's okay. food is a noun. This is a hard one.
Yeah. Okay.
I only thought of one, but there are probably others.
Well, I was thinking for drink, I would say like beverage, but I don't know about food.
Yeah, true. Drink. Yeah. Drink is a noun. Beverage. That's a great one. Or like fork or spoon. What would you call those?
Oh, like a utensil.
Yeah, utensil.
Or, okay. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I'm getting at. You can. I just think this is more like a warm up. It's an interesting topic to me, I think, because most people don't, you can sort of feel when a word is more formal or more direct, but not everyone always thinks about why that is. And I think that we have that divide in those words because Latin was the language of church and government.
Oh,
and
yeah.
that was removed from the people. And so people's home language was the one that was more direct, and that was in a lot of cases, the Anglo-Saxon. So that's why that continues to be the one that is more direct for us.
But you know what? That's a great point. So I'm thinking back to both when I taught, but when I was a student, undergrad. So I was social science, right? So I had a history major and some other things. So the faculty, without even me knowing it, I mean, the longer, more wordier, flowerier you wrote, the better grade you got. So I'm using Latinate like crazy because of that. Like I was in a humanities field, which is so, I never really classified it. To me, those words sound more sophisticated or it's like a higher level of writing. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily the case.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly not as direct. I still remember, so my husband's an engineer, so he would go the opposite way. Like, why are you writing 85 pages? This is like, you said the same thing six times.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, I know, but I'm supposed to, because that's how this works. And he wrote a half a paragraph and got to the point, but it's different ways of approaching language.
Yeah. I think we get into that habit too, because we feel like I'm going to put on my nice suit jacket and I'm going to present this in a nice way. And sometimes in our minds, that means I'm going to use that more flowery sounding language. But when we're delivering a piece of writing, it's like a machine that we're building with words. And the job of the machine is to deliver this communication from our heads to somebody else's head. But it just has that simple job, and we can keep it simple and have an elegant design. I'm saying this to sort of appeal to your engineer husband.
Right. Thank you.
Also, with my son is into computer coding, and he just heard something similar. He does an internship where he's learning how to code. And the person that he works with said that good code is spare. And it's like, you know, you don't need extra stuff in your code. It's just more stuff to go wrong.
Yeah.
And the best code is simple. It just needs to communicate that stuff. And so
that's a great analogy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, yes, we have something to talk about. <'Cause we're laughs> never on the same thing, but
I love how you explain, you know, words. When we first start thinking about ways to make our writing simple and direct, one of the first things we can start to do is think about the building blocks, which are the words we use. And that can actually work going back to things we've already written or things we need to revise, or we can certainly look at the word choice. Now, I'm just throwing this at you, so this is just off the cuff. So if I catch you off guard, let me know, but is there a certain element, though, where if I'm writing something, I do need to be somewhat consistent? So if I choose to use maybe something more Latinate, it needs to be consistent throughout? Or if I'm going to use a more direct approach, I need to stick with that? Or can they be kind of intermixed, those word choices?
I think you can balance it. But if you find you have a sentence and it's just packed, there are too many. Sometimes we get source material that's very complicated. And I think the best way to respond to complicated material or highly technical material is actually to scale back a bit on your language and be less technical with your language, because the learner's brain is already trying to handle the concept of the material. Mm-hmm. And I think to add to that more syllables and fancier words doesn't help that cognitive load.
Actually, that makes a lot of sense, because that, as a learning experience designer, you're always thinking about both your audience and the content. And so if we already have heavy duty, brand new content, very complex, let's keep our words as minimal. Yeah. Okay. That's a great way to think about it.
But I don't think that there's not a right or wrong.
Okay.
I'm still pointing out options that you have, and then you can look at your options and make your choices depending on your situation.
Well, I was thinking of an animation that we did just the other day, and I did want to use, I don't want to say more formal, but I mean, I did want to use words that seemed a little more expressive because I'm trying to create some sort of imagery in someone's head. And so I, again, kind of chose based on that.
We'll get to that later.
Oh, boy. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, we'll see. The other consideration that we have in word choice when we're looking at diction is verbs. Verbs are real powerhouses. Verbs should fuel our writing. They're like the muscle or something. That's probably not a metaphor that I'll like later, but we'll just go with that for now. So at some point along the way, we've all had a teacher say to use strong verbs. And most of the time that was talking about when you could say, you don't have just a character in a story walking into a room. You could say that they saunter or they shuffle or... instead of just saying walk, you can make that one word do a lot of work in that sentence. It's bringing character and gesture and all sorts of things and texture to the sentence in just one word. And it's better to have that one strong verb than to have something like, he walked slowly into the room.
Gotcha.
So that's a verb plus adverb.
Yep.
Then you've added a word and... You know, you could keep it a lot simpler with a nice strong verb.
So we can do simple sentences, but that doesn't mean they have to be boring. They still bring an impact because you could like high step into a room or jig. Or, I don't know. I'm just coming up with ridiculous things now, but they create a visual.
Right. And in the writing that we're doing most of the time for learning design, we don't usually end up using a strong verb in quite that way where we're adding so much color, like
right
you know,
I was ridiculous,
yeah, right,
obviously.
Like skipping or sauntering,
right,
but we can fine-tune our verbs in a way that makes our writing more accurate and clear and all that by eliminating a habit that a lot of us have, which is using a lot of extra verbs and compound verbs, I guess. So we can keep our verbs simple.
Let's maybe pick just one sort of simple sentence. Well, it's not simple yet. It's going to get there. Why don't you read it for us and maybe we can kind of illustrate what you're thinking here to make this a simple sentence.
Sure. What you'll see going on in this is there's a verb and it's kind of hidden because there's a helper verb along with
it.
The verb will sound a little bit like a noun, but before I get too far ahead of myself, I'll just read this and say, we can cut out a word in this, simplify the verb. So here's the sentence. Her constant tardiness caused disruptions in class. So the verb sounds to you like what? Her constant tardiness caused disruptions in class.
Well, disruptions would be...
Disruptions kind of sounds like a noun, I would say.
Yeah, I guess it is in that case.
Caused disruptions.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like you've tucked the verb away.
Mm-hmm.
So you could say, instead of caused disruptions, her constant tardiness disrupted the class.
Okay. Yep.
So that's something that we end up doing a lot with verbs is we say, it sounds a little businessy to say, we will conduct a demonstration of the process. When really we will demonstrate the process. So
that helps. Yeah.
So just keep in mind your teacher from way back who said use strong verbs, and that's another way to do that and keep your verbs strong is to not have things that bolster them up. Just use the simplest form.
Okay, that's really helpful, and I think it helps to partner. Our first sort of overall tip is word choice, whether we're choosing Latinate or Anglo-Saxon and making sure we have powerful verbs.
Yep.
So our second tip has to do with syntax and also related to cognitive load.
Yeah. So syntax, we just talked about diction, like you said, that's word choice. And then, but once we have all the right words, we still have to put them in the right order.
We do, right.
We were talking earlier about some other languages and translating. And if you think about English has its own particular syntax, and it's kind of the way we as other English speakers expect a sentence to unfold, and it doesn't make sense if we speak it like a German person and we say, I don't know, you know, you put your verb at the end somehow.
You've said, obviously, like we can pick the right words, but if we don't put them in the right order, then we still have an issue, or we can play around with the order sometimes. Like I had mentioned in my earlier illustration, part of what was frustrating to me was that the action was happening very quickly. And what happened was this big, long description, which eventually I found out what happened. Mm-hmm. But because it was fast paced, I really wanted this person to tell me what happened first. For example, it was a long fly ball over the fence. Okay, I know there's a home run. I can take a deep breath now. And then tell me, you know, it was a long, or that was a home run. Right. And then tell me that was a long fly ball, the outfield, or hit the fence, whatever the case might be.
Right.
So I understand we can play around with syntax, you know, order of where we put the words. To me, I suppose it's a little different too if I'm writing a book or writing poetry as opposed to if I'm designing for learning. What do I need to keep in mind?
Yeah, we will always need to vary our sentence structure a little bit, our syntax, because we don't want to have the same exact structure for every sentence because that would get really weird and boring. But we do have to be conscious of what the learner can hold in their brain as they're working through something and know that we're not trying to write a mystery story or like Hemingway establishing the scene in the desert in Spain and working our way down to what's going on. We're not building that kind of suspense. We're honoring the time of the learner and also what their brains can handle. And so we wouldn't write a sentence like, this one is not terribly extreme, but this sentence is not front-loaded. The action is going at the end. So here's one. After redoing the bathroom and painting the shutters and pouring thousands of dollars into the renovation, the Smiths sold their house.
Right.
That doesn't keep you on the hook for too long. But when we do that with something that's a lot bulkier and more technical, it would be really hard to track. And it would be a lot more helpful to say, the Smiths sold their house after redoing the bathroom, mm-hmm. you know, and putting that action up front. And that would make a bigger difference if you're writing about chemistry or engineering or really anything that is a little more complicated so that the learner doesn't have to, you know, in their subconscious brain think like, what do I have to remember? What's important here before they get to the action?
Well, and what you're alluding to here that we often forget is we are talking about the context here of most likely digital learning. Mm-hmm. So they're processing this sentence, but there's also, they're hearing the audio. They're probably not seeing the words. They're actually hearing the audio, seeing some images on screen appearing at different times. So we've got a lot of cognitive load happening here. And if they're seeing these images appear on the screen and then trying to puzzle through in their head, wait, what is this leading up to? I'm not sure what's happening. Like you said, we're creating an artificial level of cognitive load that we don't need. And I think in sort of traditional e-learning, the word cognitive load has been thrown around an awful lot. But we almost always are just thinking about what's happening on screen and is that timed correctly with the audio or even are the images appropriate and helpful? I'm not sure that we always get down to the nitty-gritty of did the words I chose and the order I put them in also contribute to the cognitive load. So I think this is we brought to light something I really think we need to think about and probably spend more time than we do, really looking at the words that we've written, the order, the syntax, and what that's contributing to for our learner.
Mm-hmm. I think we're already thinking about pacing and spacing, like you said, and we might do this better at the paragraph level or the document level than we do at the sentence level right now, because we do try to provide outlines and objectives and things like that that do put those actions up front.
That's a great idea. Yeah. So we talked about the building blocks, the words, and then we've spent some time talking about how to put them in order and cognitive load. But you have a really fun way of expressing this last sort of tip here. You said show, don't tell.
Yeah, that's certainly not, that's not mine. That's a classic thing. And that's the thing that I like to pull in from creative writing that I think is universally helpful. There's a standard principle of creative writing is to show, don't tell. And that means it's better to show in an action or in some sort of an image or something like that, what's going on or what the meaning of something is rather than just explaining it in abstract language. So you wouldn't have a character in a book say, and Tommy loved her or something. It's more engaging to show the thing that Tommy did, bringing the bouquet of flowers to the his schoolmate or something and handing it over in a certain way, then explaining it as in those abstract terms of he loved her. Well, what does that mean? You
right.
show what it means.
I see.
That's the idea behind that. And I had thought about how this relates to learning design when I was reading something that our coworker Becky wrote for us the other day when she was giving us a tutorial on writing meaningful assessments, learning mm-hmm, assessments mm-hmm. in her work. And she was talking about how assessment is more meaningful when the learner has to demonstrate what they've learned, show it in a way, rather than just regurgitating the words and,
sure.
and telling.
Right.
And I thought of what that means when I'm writing as well. And I think that that helps to have those concrete images too, because what we want is for our writing to stick in the brain. It makes this writing sticky and memorable. I worked with some material this week from a client who, in their source material, they had provided us with a metaphor already, which is an example of something concrete. They said they wanted to compare a certain kind of assessment meeting to a cruise ship, and then another kind that was sort of a faster, more regular meeting to a speedboat.
Hmm, I love that. Yeah.
And already, you know, you could see how that helps. It's tying this abstract language or this abstract idea to something that you can imagine in your head. And they've provided that for the learner, and already it makes the concept more sticky because you can continue to associate the two things with that. And for me, I was like, oh, well, thanks. It's like a gift, because then I can take those two images and stay with them through through the interaction and work with them further.
Well, I think we've talked quite a bit when we design digital learning experiences, whenever possible, we try to wrap some sort of larger theme around it, kind of the old standby is like a journey that the learner's mm-hmm. going to take, and but whatever that might be, it's exactly what you said. We're trying to create a metaphor that creates a visual. It engages the right brain, all aspects mm-hmm. of the brain, and it's stickier.
Yeah, and especially when it's a sensory image, mm-hmm. Something that involves how something feels or smells or mm. or looks, and then that adds extra stickiness.
Well, and to not go back into just prior podcasts, but when we talk about brain science, what we're doing is we're connecting the neurons mm-hmm. in our brain from a topic that's new to something we already know, mm-hmm. and that's making a stronger connection, which mm-hmm. means you're going to remember it more, and it's stickiness. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Well, I so appreciate, I mean, I love the fact that I have kind of this, I would say this podcast is the one I approached with the most trepidation, which that's a good word.
I hope you appreciate it.
<No. laughs> But breaking it into three kind of concrete, first of all, word choice and why that's important, and more specifically, what I should think about, and then how I put them in order. And then lastly, trying to provide writing that has examples or that can be visual, or it's calling up a metaphor in my mind to make my writing simple and plain, but still very sticky. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Yeah.
Such great ideas. And I'm always interested, especially with your varied interests. I know from poetry to kayaking and all those. This is the last question I always ask on the podcast. What are you learning well now?
Lately, it's going to sound funny, but I got into spoon carving.
Oh.
This is, I was hoping to surprise you with that.
It is a surprise.
Sounds
weird.
You're
going to have to tell me more.
Yeah, I think during COVID, a lot of people picked up some new crafts or some old ones and are kind of got back to doing things with their hands a little bit. There's actually a small trend of people who began to do some whittling and carving.
Okay.
And there's a particular school of that called Sloyd, which is a Scandinavian method. It's a way of teaching children too. It's kind of like their version of Montessori, where it's teaching children how to handle tools and carefully and make the basics and stuff like that. So my daughter and I took a workshop and learned how to properly do some carving. And the reason I like that kind of thing is I like to do things with my hands, and it gets me out of my head,
yes.
which is I really,
yes.
really need. And I'm
yes.
not a terribly athletic person, so I like things like that to help me do that.
You brought up two things there. One, I was going to ask you, how did you learn it? Right? Because mm-hmm. we have all kinds of people say everything from I watched a YouTube video to somebody stood by me and taught me to, in this case, you took a workshop. But I hear this a lot, honestly, when I ask people, what are they learning well now when they're in our field? Oftentimes it involves doing something physical with your hands, or whether it's some sort of sport, or it's in the garden, or because we spend all day staring at a screen and parsing nouns and verbs or whatever. Really, we're doing a lot of higher order thinking all day long. And it's important. And this, again, ties into brain science. It's important to step away, to give your brain a break. It actually forms new connections when it's not thinking so terribly hard about one thing. So while you are whittling your spoons, your brain is taking a break. It's forming new connections. I love that. It's really interesting. So how many spoons have you made?
I've only done a couple. Okay. I'm brand new to it. It takes a long time. But we did a two-day workshop out in Ann Arbor where we did that all day.
Wow.
And I have to say, when I came back from it, I felt really refreshed. And I just felt like I was thinking clearly. And it really did feel like a break for my brain. And I really like that hands-on kind of learning.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And I want to thank our listeners, too. If you're looking to interact more with us, you can find our posts on MindSpring's Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn every time we release this podcast. We're hoping to get more audience interaction, so feel free to respond, ask questions, whatever those things might be. And most importantly, we thank you all for listening. We know your time is a gift, and we thank you for choosing to spend it with us.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Learning Well podcast. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please leave some feedback on whatever platform you're streaming on. We'd really appreciate it. We'll see you in the next episode.